the last kina that we're going to do before Alei Tzion, which is how we always end off, of course, is a kina on the Holocaust. We normally do Rav Schwab's, I think, right? So that is, yeah. So just indulge me for just a little bit longer. This is my first Tisha B'Av after losing my connection with the Holocaust, my Zaydi Zatzal. So I'm going to ask that you forgive me for getting a little more personal than usual. Shkula Misa Sadikim Kastreif Asbeis Elokeinu. But when you're zochet to not only see a tzaddik from the periphery, but you're zochet to be connected in a real and powerful and meaningful way, then that loss, even at the age of 94, is more poignantly felt. And this is not just me, you know, using you as my form of therapy. I'm speaking about my Zaydi, and I'm speaking personally about his story and who he was, but that's really the story of a generation of people. The story of those who managed to build families, to reconnect to Torah, to ensure the continuity of Klal Yisrael, despite witnessing unfathomable darkness. My Zaydi grew up without a father, but his family, he says, was financially comfortable. He was raised in the model of Chassam Sofer of Pressburg, not Hasidish, but one of his brothers became fully Hasidish. Later, he attached himself a little bit more to Hasidus. He knew tragedy as a young child, not only with the loss of his father, but also the loss of one of his brothers at a very, very young age. I think I seem to recall the story that he was electrocuted by touching a live wire or something like that, something horrible. He was from Ungvar, which was mostly Jewish. Not a single store in the neighborhood, he said, was open on Shabbos. He had a Jewish education. He would study secular subjects in Czech until 1 p.m. and then have Torah instruction from 2 to 5 p.m. And he said there was an atmosphere of just being a Jew. Those who didn't go to Jewish schools would still learn Chumash Rashi a few times a week. During the war, he was in Buchenwald in Auschwitz. He started in Auschwitz, and it was liquidated. He ended up in Buchenwald. Most of the time, he was there in Buchenwald. He was in Auschwitz for 8 months. He traveled for a month, and then the rest of the time was in Buchenwald. And he had nobody from his large family with him. A few boys from his city, some of them actually ended up in Lawrence, that he remained close with to the end. So how did he survive? Any survivor, anyone who survived, had a series of miracles. He once described to my son Yisrael, who had in Yeshiva Katana, they had an assignment to do an interview with a child of a Holocaust survivor. They couldn't imagine that you would actually be able to interview an actual Holocaust survivor. So Yisrael asked his teacher if he can have an exception and be allowed to just interview a super Zaydi, an actual Holocaust survivor. And the teacher said, you know, that was the original plan, obviously. So we have this treasure of an interview. Was it seventh grade? And my grandfather described, he would never talk to us like this. It took another generation. He described that he felt hopeless. Again, like we said before, that no sense in crying because there's nothing to cry for. And he said the greatest miracle that happened to him was that he was never sick for a single day that he was there. He said, had I been sick, they would have killed me immediately. He said, looking back, realizing that under those conditions that I never got sick, Hashem took care of me. There's no other explanation how you can survive on a half a cup of coffee and a cup of soup and sometimes a half a slice of bread. He said when they were moved from Auschwitz to Buchenwald, they started with 20,000 and 500 of them made it. And there were times where he more poignantly and directly escaped death. When he was in Auschwitz and Mengele told him to go left and he snuck and went to the right. Many, many instances. When they were walking to Buchenwald, the Americans were constantly bombing and somehow none of them were killed by the bombs. SS people were killed. And he described liberation. What it was like in Buchenwald at the time, they were taking out a few hundred people every day to be shot in the woods. Zaidi said he couldn't walk anymore, he was too weak. He said he thinks it was a Tuesday morning, early in the morning. Someone said, look. And they saw tanks coming into Buchenwald. He had never seen an African-American person before. So this is not a racist comment. But the American soldiers were black and they had camouflage on them and they were wearing like leaves from their helmets. And he said, I've seen tanks before, but I've never seen that kind of creature on top of a tank. He suffered many, many more tragedies after the war as well. The death of my grandmother in her early 50s. The death of my Aunt Joanne in her early 40s. And considering everything that he went through, Zaidi was impossibly positive. The happiest person I knew. From the youngest of ages, we remember Zaidi telling us stories. He was a fabulous storyteller. As we got older, we realized that he was making them up as he was going along. He himself didn't know how the story was going to end. Usually feeding off of our reaction, seeing what we liked about the story and stressing those points. He spent so much time with us as children. Tell us bedtime stories, taking us to amusement parks. We used to call them Zaidi rides. Cooking for us, making us delicious breakfast, Sufkan Yod and Hanukkah. And growing up, in my mind, the picture of somebody who learns Torah was my Zaidi. My father got into learning in Daf Yomi a little bit later on, and other things also, but my Zaidi, as a young child, no matter how early you'd wake up in the morning, you'd come downstairs and you'd find Zaidi at the kitchen table with a huge Gemara and a huge Rambam. That was the picture of a certain tzura of a Jew. It wasn't a program. It wasn't a fancy speaker. It's just that's what a Jew does in the morning. You wake up at 4 and you learn. His formative years of learning were taken away from him. Zaidi was humble. He was not demanding of us at all. He would just give us unending amounts of love. All the messages that he taught us were through the things that he would talk about, his own personal example, never through demands. There were certain like clear messages that our entire family took. In recent years, as his health started to deteriorate, and after he suffered, in recent decades after he suffered all the tragedies that he suffered, the refrain was no complaints. How are you doing, Zaidi? No complaints. No matter what, there was never anything to complain about. Hashem was so good to me. Message of consistency. Daf Yomi was like built for him, and he built Daf Yomi in Rehovot. Didn't matter how business was going, it didn't matter how well or unwell he felt, it didn't matter, Daf waits for nobody. And that sense of consistency, coupled with Baruch Hashem Arichas Yamim, allowed a regular balabas to finish Shas Bavli, I think, seven times. Shas Mishnah is many dozens of times. All of Sefer Tehillim more times than you can count. No shtick. Just learning the basics. He taught us to always grow, take on more. After Babi died, Mishnayos were added to the Daf and the Rambam and Sefer Tehillim almost daily, the entire Sefer, after he retired. He taught us to take some time to enjoy the Nachas, to look at his grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren. He was thrilled about each and every one of them. I remember when I was too young to be having this conversation, but I must have been, my grandmother died when I was early high school. My grandparents had a very loving relationship. They would call each other Dolly. I'm not sure where that came from, but that's what they would call each other. I remember my grandmother telling me, again, I don't know why exactly, that she never ever doubted for a second how much my grandfather loves her, but that she also knows that no love he has compares to the love he has for his grandchildren. Because like so many other survivors, the family that he built was, that was his revenge. That was his revenge against Hitler. Unlike other survivors, he articulated something I've shared here before. He told me and my brother, and he's told it to others in our family as well, that if Hashem were to come to him and tell him, hey, you could start fresh, you could do it all again, the same life with Auschwitz and Buchenwald, with all the suffering, but you get to see so many descendants, Shomrei Torah Mitzvos, Lomdei Torah, Marbitzei Torah. He said, I would sign up for it again in a second. The Kochos HaNefesh of the people that went through the Holocaust of that generation, it's the stuff that we can't even be masig. How much was lost? Their entire lives, their entire world was lost to them. As we said before, afterwards they had nowhere to go. There was nothing to try and find some third cousin in America, maybe, and you'll move to Dallas and find some basement to stay. They had nowhere, they had nothing. And look what they managed to build. And the sense of loss as the Holocaust survivors are slowly leaving us. It's really, at this point, you know, each death of a Holocaust survivor at this point is not a tragedy. They're all old. They're very old. So it's not a tragedy in that sense. The Rizokha Tarich Yom, whoever's still dying now, whoever's still living now, Rizokha to certain Arichos Yom. But for us, it's still a tragedy because these are our heroes. And when you're guiding light, when your hero is God, it's disorienting. You have to draw in memory. I remember right before my grandfather died, a few days, when his condition was taking a turn for the worse, so I just sort of warned my wife, I said, you know, I'm not going to be okay. You know, we deal with a lot of things communally and, you know, Klal Yisrael wise and friends and family and things. And, you know, we deal with them and we have to know ourselves, and we have to know, like, when we're going to need a little extra chizuk, a little extra support. So, like, my wife deals with more than most. I just felt like I had to warn her that, like, you know, when those kinds of things happen, where, like, you'll find me pacing in the room from 3 to 4 a.m., like, we're gonna have that. Amazing thing is, I found that it didn't happen. Because that was also one of Zaidi's lessons. That you go on, and you smile, and you're productive, and you do more. That was the lesson of every survivor. Every one of us, I mean, if you think about the fact that we are sitting here today, almost everyone here is a descendant of at least a survivor. Not everybody, probably, but almost everybody. That means that we being here today is a miracle. And it's a miracle not only of the Yad Hashem in escaping death time and time again, but it's a miracle of the human spirit. It's a miracle of a generation that was made of different stuff, that knew how to turn ashes into and build yeshivas and shuls and communities and families and love and chizik. It's most appropriate that on Tisha B'Av, this kina is almost like a centerpiece. It's not just an add-on at the end, even though that's where it appears in the kinos, but it's a focal point of our attention. Azocher maskira.